Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday. It's the 7th of June, and we're thrilled to have you with us. Very nice to have everybody here, and we welcome you. All we ask for you to do to be a part of our conversation is to write to us. It's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. Let me introduce the panel to you. We'll get started. We have a lot to talk about today, a lot of interesting stories and things to bring up as we get into... hot weather. It's hard. I don't know. Last Saturday, I saw my breath.
Yeah,
and then
right.
This is past Saturday.
Right, you know, saw all the sweat.
Right, it was 90 degrees.
Yeah.
And we were literally melting. So, it's good to have you all here. 14 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock, and let's get started. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I don't even want to tell you my troubles.
Okay.
All right. Well, then moving on. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, tell me about your troubles. No. Sienna is an immigration attorney and a partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good to be here in person.
This is Sienna's first time. Sienna was one of those people who is a COVID baby. she came to us in the infancy of COVID and has not been in the building ever. So it's wonderful to see you and to meet you and to have you here after many hours of discussion on the air. Yes. So good morning. Good morning. Tetherless Whirl, professor of computer, web, and cognitive sciences at RPI and director of the RPI IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Henler is here. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Joe.
How are you?
I'm good. Good to see you. Good to see Sienna in person. And it's so weird to be just seeing people like normal again.
I know it is weird, but it is good. I will make this. You know, we've been trying to get this point home, but everyone here is vaccinated. We only come in if you're vaccinated. The panelists sign their life away to prove that they've been vaccinated, and we've been very careful here, and we continue to be so. So, Libby Post, mm-hmm. You've passed all your health checks. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I think I said this before. I have the Excelsior pass.
I know. That's
and
pretty
I'm
good.
So, you know, I feel so with it and cool, but... with the cool kids.
Without giving anybody a plug and without saying anything, I bought a ticket for a local event here in the Capital Region last night, and which requires the Excelsior Pass, and it's in the first week of August. My God, that was the best feeling in the world.
Yeah.
I was like,
oh,
this is great, because all you have to do is you have to show your Excelsior Pass to get in.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh,
it's,
I have that.
Yeah.
That's
great. Friday? Yes, Friday is our anniversary, so we're going... to the Barrington stage. They're doing something
On Gershwin.
The Gershwin thing.
We're going to have Julianne Boyd on later on today.
Oh great. I can't wait. I love Gershwin.
So let me ask you, I think this is a fair question, but how many years for you?
26.
God love you all.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Well, congratulations to you.
Thank
congratulations
you.
To Lynn.
And she's probably home turning red, but that's okay.
That's all right. Well, you are, I've told you this, but you are just like the greatest couple.
Oh, thank you.
You're just so sweet.
Much. She is very sweet,
other?
And she really counterbalances
yes,
me. There's
absolutely.
No two ways about that.
I love the two of you. Watching the dynamic between the two of you is lovely. All right. Good morning, everyone. Let's get started. We've got a lot to talk about. I wasn't even going to start with this story, but I'm now rather perplexed, confused, and just fascinated by it. So let's begin there. So Friday afternoon, the governor of the state of New York came out and said to schools, all right, we're lifting the mask mandate. We know there's only 2 weeks to go in school, and we know that this may cause a boatload of problems for area school districts, but what the hell? Even though a certain member of the a large part of the school population has yet to be vaccinated, we'll just knock it out of the park. We don't need to do it. So the schools went into this rush
hyperdrive.
They went into meetings all weekend, districts, superintendents, school boards meeting all over the state of New York, trying to figure out how they were going to implement the lifting of the mask ban. And saying, this is crazy. Why couldn't they just give us a couple more weeks? We'll finish school. We can figure this out in the fall. Wouldn't that be nice? But no, we have to figure this out. So they get to all of their meetings. They have the big meeting at 11 o'clock yesterday morning. They figure everything out, and they figure, all right, well, this is what we're going to do. Because he left it up to the individual school districts past that buck. So Then they get out of the meeting, they get home, they check their email, and the State Department says, yeah, we decided that since we haven't heard from the CDC, we're not going to do that now. So I bring this up only because it just seems to me to be a perfect symptom to our overall problem as of where we are now of trying to figure out what's right, trying to figure out what's wrong, saying that we're following the science, and then just saying, just kidding. And that's really hard. And so New York will not be lifting the mask mandate in schools for now. And what I also love about this story is then you blame the CDC. I just think that's great, too, because you're the one who caused all this because you were following the CDC guidance. You decide not to follow the CDC guidance, and then you blame it on the CDC for not notifying the school districts in time. Alan.
Well, you know, the governors of these states and the mayors have a particular problem. We've talked about it before. They want to open things up because people are really getting ticked off, for want of a better word, Halevy. and they're really getting ticked off, and they are, and the governors know that their popularity to some degree, especially a guy who I believe is going to run in New York for a fourth term, and have been saying that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And he is just determined to give the people what they want. And what they want is an opening up. So now he does this thing on the masks. The CDC does. You're absolutely right, Joe. Becomes very convenient, as somebody to blame. But the fact is these kids haven't been vaccinated yet. And therefore, it doesn't make any sense to say, okay, proceed and at a great risk to yourself. So that's where I am.
Right now, the CDC says fully vaccinated people can resume activities without wearing a mask or physically distancing, which is what we're doing in the studio right now. But it's only, what is it, 11 or 12? 12 and up. Mm-hmm. So anybody from 0 to 12 has not been vaccinated, mm-hmm. which is a very large part of the school population.
And not that many 12 and above have been vaccinated either.
Correct.
And then you put on top of that the crazy anti-vaxxers who don't want their kids to be vaccinated just because they, you know, want to take their medical advice from Jenny McCarthy. And so, you know, it's
those of you wishing to respond to Libby personally, Libby Post, POST.
At WAMC.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm waiting for the day when these vaccines become, well, I don't know what the CDC calls them. Now they're emergency. Once they no longer are emergency but are seen as standard fare, then they will be mandated. And I'm sorry. Well, actually, I'm not sorry. They should be mandated. Everyone should have to get vaccinated. And that's the end of the conversation. People need to understand how deadly this disease is. And we've lost, what, over 500,000 people?
600,000
just
plus.
In this country alone? I'm sorry. This is what needs to be done. And we need to still take the precautions. And these parents need to get their kids vaccinated. So, and the 12 to and 18-year-olds are not flocking right now either.
Right.
They need to go into the schools and do it.
Mike Cornell is a president of the Erie Niagara School Superintendents Association. He said, we as school superintendents again find ourselves in the position to have to ask our parents and our families and our staff that they have patience while we wait for the state to sort this out. This is mind-boggling because it didn't have to necessarily be this
right.
way.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it was a optics. I understand what the governor was thinking, right? Because as a parent, you know, to have to take your kid to the store where no one's wearing masks, and then they go to school, they're wearing masks, and then you're taking off the mask. It's on and off and on and off with the mask throughout the day. I pick up my kids, I put my mask on, I'm at work all day, no mask off. You know, so I get why it's confusing. It can be confusing, but it makes sense because the children are not vaccinated. They just aren't. I get emails almost weekly from the school district about, you know, breakouts of someone having COVID. I mean, it's happening in the schools. We know it. So I don't think many parents are opposed to the mask being on. I just understand why. I understand the optics behind it because we are taking masks on and off as adults who are vaccinated.
Jim.
You know, I think the bottom line is something I think I said a couple weeks ago on the show, which is that the CDC is great scientists, but they're not great social scientists. Okay. And they really needed someone to be providing not just political advice, but also just people advice, just helping them understand how to make, you know, how to start these announcements, how, which things should have been very clear guidance, which things should have been ramped in. And so the science is pretty clear. It's not that what we're doing is wrong, but they really needed to make it a lot clearer than just one day saying, hey, great, it's all over.
And Walensky herself has done a pretty poor job of it, reversing herself and
agreed. Yeah.
I mean, not good.
We have to remember that the CDC was in total disarray.
Oh, yes.
For the last four years.
Yes.
And what, it's only been 4 months or 5 months? Six months, I guess, since the new administration has come in. And, it could very well be that the CDC doesn't have the right public affairs people in place yet.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
maybe
what it seems.
Well, Michael Lewis, who wrote the new book Premonition on this case, makes the argument that the CDC has been bogged down in bureaucracy for a long, long time. And we're just seeing the result of this over many, many years, not just through the Trump administration, but many years of issues. But to Jim's point, there is a scientist in that book who says the CDC is really good at reports and telling you what happened. They're not nearly as good as using the science they have to tell you what is happening.
And in part, that's not their job the way it's set up, but it should be. And it's, you know, a lot of it could be better, and you end up with these crazy situations. You know, Fauci is suddenly the villain on the right for reasons no rational person can understand. Excuse me.
I think you're right.
You know, they need somebody to attack. You know, he's a big face out there, but it's crazy. It's an anti-science feeling coupled with politics, coupled with really this very individual-driven politics.
It's the politics of grievance and grudge.
Grievance, grudge, and privilege.
And ignorance.
It's me. You know,
right.
It's all
right,
about me.
Right.
It's not about us.
Right.
Nevertheless, it seems to me they should be able to figure this out and at least have a spokesman who is rational and to the point. Yeah. And I think I had great hopes for Walensky, but I don't think she's done well in this thing. She's panicked. She goes into panic, and then the next day she's not panicked. It's not good.
But I don't know why, if you know on 3 o'clock on a Friday, going back to the state of New York, of why you have to make this announcement with 2 weeks of school left, just seems
adds to
the panic.
I told you why. The governor wants the credit for opening things up. And he's in big trouble.
Frankly, it never works. You know, we always end up in this case where we it happens and then they take it back, and then it happens and they take it back, and then a bunch of people do work and they take it back. You know, so you don't even get that credit because it always ends up not working out.
It just shows you the politics of desperation on Cuomo's part right now.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's so much, many levels to the layers to this story. But on top of it, on this issue of, you know, because the kids aren't getting vaccinated, and Libby, you pointed to this a moment ago, but people aren't getting vaccinated. The new numbers are really disturbing. The vaccination rates are falling off. The president has a July 4th goal, I believe, of 70%. And most places aren't anywhere near that. Plummeting vaccination rates have turned what officials hoped would be the last mile of the coronavirus immunization campaign into a marathon, threatening President Biden's goal of getting shots of at least 70% of adults by July 4th. The U.S. is averaging fewer than 1 million shots a day, a decline of more than two-thirds from the peak of $3.4 million in April, according to the Washington Post 7-day analysis. Even though all adults and children over the age of 12 are now eligible, small armies of health workers and volunteers often outnumber the people showing up to get shots at clinics around the country, from a drive-in site in Chattanooga, Tennessee, to a gymnasium in Provo, Utah, or to a park in Raleigh, North Carolina. Anecdotally, if you go to the Crossgates Mall, to the former Lord & Taylor app,
that's right.
location. There is a vaccination site there. Also a site at Aviation Mall in Queensbury. And there's a lot of cars there, but most of those are staff and very few people waiting to get in.
There is a political aspect to this. Sorry about this. But we do know that the northern states have huge, great groups of people who have taken the vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Trump states, mm-hmm. put mildly, are the ones who are resisting it like crazy, just like they resisted the masks.
I'm so glad you're the one saying this, Alan.
What, do you think I'm going to get a
certain But, you know, there's no vaccine for stupid.
You don't know about the stupid vaccine?
No, I don't.
but New York has a 47% vaccination rate. California has a 44% vaccination rate. Texas has a 36% vaccination rate. Florida has a 40% vaccination rate. And Pennsylvania has a 44% vaccination rate. So all of those states, very far from 70%.
Yes.
Jim is looking at me askance.
So, yeah, I think, well, that's you're fully vaccinated. So that's mm-hmm. two shots plus right. 2 weeks. So, I mean, the first shot number is a lot higher. And in fact, one of the worrying things is people getting the first shot and not the second. But, you know, I did see some interesting analyses of these. One of the things that's interesting is the states that have the highest vaccination rates right now are the ones that, instead of rushing to get everybody vaccinated, you know, constantly opening up the categories, they did sort of what we did here, which is they set some categories and then they worked very hard to get everybody in that category, and particularly outreach to poorer people, to minority populations, to tribal populations. So if you look at New England, the rates are much higher than anywhere else.
I was going to say, Alan's home state of Massachusetts wins with 56%, so the highest in the country.
And if you think about all the people who are complaining about how bad Massachusetts was.
We have to take a break. We'll do that. We'll come back. We'll continue our discussion. We welcome your letters. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Jim Hendler, and Libby Post with us this morning. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We have letters. Anne writes, U.S. employers can currently require their employees to get the vaccine. They can also ask their employees if they have been vaccinated. It is not a violation of HIPAA. If employees say they haven't been vaccinated, employers can ask them why, as it is a violation, cannot ask them why, as it is a violation of the ADA.
So I just want to be clear. Employers can mandate?
Yeah.
They can mandate, but I also think I don't know this being brought up, but that's different than what the schools are asking.
Yeah.
Right.
No,
I mean, there's a separation there. Yeah. Yeah.
No, but I'm talking about private sector employers.
Mm-hmm. Sienna?
They can mandate. The EEOC has made it that it's not a discriminatory. That's what they came out and say to the EEOC. So you can't bring a claim against an employer if they ask you about whether or not you've been vaccinated. And this is important because this shows that we might be rolling slowly, maybe, towards school, making it mandatory like everything else that you discussed, which will be a big deal. Because right now, you guys might not have heard, but a lot of people, there's litigation, right, between pet parents, right? The parents are on two sides of the aisle of vaccination. What does the child do? Who does the child get vaccinated? Making this decision on a government level, it makes it easier for judges in this situation.
Oh, yeah.
So with kids being opening up kids, younger kids, because 12 and up, they have a little more autonomy, right? You're going to have these discussions with your kids. But when you get the younger kids involved, now we have family courts that are going to get more involved in this discussion, right? And so having the EEOC come out with this in the private sector, moving on, hopefully, to schools making it mandatory, except for the obvious, the usual exclusions, may help.
Does that include the nonprofit sector?
Yes. Okay. I mean, EEOC covers everything. Now, New York government hasn't come out and said anything about what their discriminatory laws are, but the EEOC is the federal level,
and
right?
So the state would have to follow EEOC, wouldn't
yes.
they?
I mean, EEOC is the floor.
Okay.
So I'm fascinated by it. So if there is a disruption between two parents, and you have one parent saying they want the kid to be vaccinated, they have another parent that says they don't want to get the kid vaccinated. So what is that usually part of a divorce proceeding? Or not necessarily. So it can just be an issue between the two parents.
I mean, it comes down to legal custody, right? For the most part, people have legal custody. Parents have joint legal custody. They make these medical decisions together. So when you go into the doctor and you make a medical decision for your child, they have to agree. That's most parents have joint legal custody. And so what you'll see is they may, it's not even part of the divorce proceedings, they may not have thought about it in the divorce proceedings. It might be over and done, but now we have this new issue of the vaccine. So people might have to go back into court to litigate and get the judge to order that they're allowed, this child is allowed to get the vaccine. That's what that looks like. And what it looks like in a trial, I imagine, is bringing in a medical expert to say, what would the impact be on the child if they got the vaccine or if they didn't get the vaccine? That's what that would look like.
And as you say, that's what this will look like, which means that we're just starting to see this.
We're just starting to see this, yes, yeah. Exactly.
And they might have parents who are happily married disagreeing on this.
Exactly.
And ending up in court, too.
Well, and we have, suits about whether it can be mandated because of the emergency rules. And we have suits about it can, what the rules are on privacy and things. The HIPAA one is very clear, by the way, that we've studied
now
quite
it
extensively.
Is.
It's being used as an excuse. You can voluntarily offer any health information you want. Furthermore, any individual aspect of your health that doesn't violate ADA or some other things is not necessarily protected. What's protected is your health records and a lot of the history stuff.
And yet a lot of people
were very highly
and yet
protected.
A lot of people were tossing that around, and now that's at least been clarified.
So to bring it back to what you were saying about the governor coming out and saying no mask in schools and then coming back, and then that's very confusing for parents, especially when you have two parents. You have a divorced parents or separated parents or, you know.
A Republican and a Democratic
parent. Yeah, well,
exactly.
That's
but
true.
It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. So in a lot of communities of color, it may be two Democrats, but they may both, you know, they may fall on different sides of the vaccine because one doesn't trust it and one does. And so it's not always by party lines. It might just be by education or the amount of information they have about it. And so it's becoming a really tense issue. I know it's a tense issue between me and my hairdresser.
So, don't give the hairdresser custody of your children.
Right. Or make sure he or she wears a mask when they're doing your hair. Because, you know, if they're not getting the vaccine.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. But that would be very contentious. Of course it would. Anthony writes to us and says, I could not disagree with Libby more. You ready, Libby? One more?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. This is from Anthony. You can write him back if you want. I'm totally pro-vaccine and I'm fully vaccinated. If you follow the science, the vaccine should be fully vetted before lifting emergency authorization. I don't blame anyone for not taking the vaccine at this point in time. There still is a risk, albeit small, and the vaccine is not universally applicable and effective for the whole population. If you choose not to take the risk, you must follow the precautions. This seems to be lost in recent coverage. My 4-year-old daughter cannot be vaccinated. Therefore, even though my wife and I are fully vaccinated, we still wear masks in all indoor public settings and follow the same precautions that we have for the last year. Our vaccine is only 90% effective, and there are still unknown strains of COVID-19 circulating the planet. There are lots of unknowns still. We all want this to be over, but let's not jump to the finish line. We've made great progress, but this challenge is not over yet. I don't completely see where he disagrees with you, but go ahead.
You know, I understand what he's saying, and I agree with a bunch of what he said, especially if his daughter can't be vaccinated for medical reasons. That's fine. The thing is this. The people who don't believe in vaccines also don't believe in masks or public health. That's the problem. That's the connection between all
of
this.
Not all people, but
many of them.
But just remember, there were 9 New York Yankees, all of whom... Nine New York Yankees, all of whom had been vaccinated, fully vaccinated, and they all got it.
So, but... one of the things
is that the 5%?
Well, you know, we don't know what the full percentage are, but what we do know is that the people who get it after vaccination have significantly less serious problems.
Well,
so even after the first vaccination. So there's a lot of people who've had a first vaccination and between that and the second have caught COVID, and typically it's a very, very mild case. Remember what the percentages of people who are ending up in the hospital and ending up dead. That's completely different for the people who've been vaccinated.
600,000 dead people.
That's right. I mean, you know, we treat this like it's nothing, and this is the biggest tragedy we've had in this country in a long time.
But my understanding, and I know there were sort of competing articles on this, but the of this very small number, and I'll admit that in talking about it, But Alan brought up the New York Yankees. Of the people who have been vaccinated who test positive, they still don't know what the rate of spreading is among, right? We don't know whether they are able to spread to others, even though they're positive. I mean, the greatest, this is being looked at because of this golfer who was several shots ahead over the weekend, and they tapped him on the shoulder and said, oh, by the way, he broke down in tears. And what in his situation was, yes, he had been vaccinated. However, he was vaccinated after he had become in contact with somebody with COVID with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So it didn't hold. But we don't know about that, right? About the spreading?
I mean, you know, again, we're studying all this. What we do know is very simple. It's better with the vaccine than without it.
Right.
And that if people don't take the vaccine, you get more of the variants that we're scared about. There's a new variant from India that's starting to hit Britain, right? We are at a vaccination rate.
We're going to have to get Dr. Fagan back.
We will. Yeah. Now, we have another listener who's wants to take issue with Hula because you said that there is no vaccine for stupid, and Corinne says listening to NPR should be considered the vaccine for stupid.
I totally agree. The problem is that the people who don't take the vaccines probably aren't listening.
Some of them do.
Let me see.
Leave that for another day, but I have my issues with NPR, that's for sure.
Well, WAMC, let me be clear. Yeah. Okay.
T writes, Massachusetts doesn't have the best COVID-19 vaccination rate. Vermont has the...
Yeah, they do.
Little tiny 80%. Vermont does.
80%.
Yeah. And there's a lot less people in Vermont, so
they're right.
It's like New Hampshire.
Exactly. You know.
All right, and let's see. I think... okay. The science well supports that children under 12 and likely up to 18 rarely, if ever, seriously ill or even transmit the virus. The teachers have had their fair shot as the general community. The virus will always be around, and we will never be able to entirely vaccinate it ourselves out of this new reality. COVID will become a perennial virus like the flu, and regular vaccine updates will be suggested as a routine vaccination and required in certain settings, such as in healthcare facilities, much like the flu vaccine is. I've been up close and personal with the virus throughout the pandemic, and a more nuanced and measured approach, unfortunately, is not possible in public health with lay people. But as the reality is that the vaccines are here, the science is far along, and we need to move on. All right.
I think that's well said. And that does correspond with what we're seeing in the numbers and all the data and stuff that I'm not citing.
I respect that you fully understood it, Jim. We go to Bob, who says, it's easy to say the vaccinations for COVID-19 should be made mandatory, but doesn't that open the door to mandating vaccinations for regular flu, which kills tens of thousands every year, and then for all manner of peremptory medical treatments?
The slippery slope argument always comes in. Well, I mean, you know, we have mandatory polio vaccines.
Right.
We have mandatory, and we generally make that decision based on the severity of the disease versus the efficacy of the vaccination. So with flu, you know, it's a constant battle. Flu is really constantly evolving and changing, and you get these many, many different strands, and that's why we have to have a yearly shot. We don't know yet whether COVID's going to look like that or not. There's an assumption that there will be a time you'll need a booster. What we don't know is if it's going to be a year, 18 months, 5 years, whatever. And that's what the data is now being collected on.
And then, too, comes what shows up every once in a while, the measles.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who do not want to give their kids measles shot, want to endanger my grandchildren, and, you know, they don't give a damn.
Yep.
So I think those are things we have to talk about. Mm-hmm.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have new topics to discuss, and we'll do just that. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Jim Henler, and Webby Post will continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A few minutes before we go to our top of the hour break, Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Jim Henler, and Webby Post all in studio, vaccinated and ready to take your questions. All right, let's go to other items making news here and things that we can talk about. So let's talk about Joe Manchin. We left Friday talking about Joe Manchin, so let's talk some more about Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin, the Democrat of West Virginia, appeared to slam the door on the far-reaching measure when he vowed to block Democratic voting rights bill and to preserve the filibuster. This is our friend Mr. Manchin, as David Soares calls him. A Democrat of West Virginia appeared to slam the door on the far-reaching measure when he wrote that he would not vote for any partisan voting bill. He said on Sunday in no uncertain terms that he would not vote for the Democrats' bill to combat voter suppression, nor would he ever end the legislative filibuster, a written promise that imperils much of President Biden's agenda. The bill, which all the other Senate Democrats had supported and the party had portrayed as an urgent effort to preserve American democracy, would roll back dozens of laws being passed by Republican state legislatures to limit early and mail-in voting and empower partisan poll watchers. The measure, known as the For the People Act, would also restore many of the ethical controls on the presidency that Donald Trump shattered. In the Charleston Gazette Mail, the newspaper of the capital of his home state, Mr. Manchin, a Democrat, wrote, quote, "I believe that partisan voting legislation will destroy the already weakening binds of our democracy, and for that reason, I will vote against the For the People Act. Furthermore, I will not vote to weaken or eliminate the filibuster." Folks, I know we have talked about this before, but can someone please explain to me how this voting legislation is partisan and would, quote, weaken the binds of our democracy?
There's one rule here for elected officials. Get elected, get reelected. That's all this is about. Joe Manchin is playing to his electorate. You know, he's a Democrat. Well, he's sort of a Republican, but he's a Democrat in a Republican red state, West Virginia. He's popular, but he can't veer too far to the center in order to get reelected. And that's what this is all about. And, you know, this is my problem with elected officials is that, you know, it's all about their power and getting reelected.
Your only problem?
Well, my biggest problem. And not doing what's right and going after policy initiatives that are right in the long run. And this bill, once the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, it opened the door for everything we're seeing now across the country, these voter suppression legislation. And Manchin has the ability to do the right thing. And honestly, while I love the fact that Chuck Schumer is majority leader and we've got that very slim majority, what's the use if Manchin is going to stand in the way of progress?
Alan talked to Chuck Schumer on Friday. We're going to air that interview today. Any hints on
doing away with that filibuster. I have issues with it. I mean, I'm not quite as sure as everybody else is because let's just say in the next by-election, mm-hmm. the Republicans take it both.
Right.
They'll do anything they wanted to. And that is the downside of the filibuster. I don't like the filibuster. I'm all opposed to it. I think, you know, it is anti-democratic and all the rest. But that's where Chuck's going to be.
So I know this is a silly. Okay,
he says. By the way, call him Chuck. He says, don't call me.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, that's good. It's a long relationship that merits that, I think. Don't laugh at me. You know, I know. I asked questions, and when you all weren't here, and I was alone in the studio, and if you were laughing at me, I couldn't tell. But now I can tell. So don't laugh at me. When I ask this question. But is it possible? Is it possible? I'm just asking the question. It won't hurt anybody. I'm just asking the question. Is it possible that a Republican could say, we need this legislation?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Oh, yeah? Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
I thank you for not thinking it's silly.
I thought about it, too. I mean, it is possible. It is possible for somebody like Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski or any of the ones who voted to impeach him, to impeach the president whose name we will not say. You know, you've got Mitt Romney. I mean, it's about power over people. And what are they going to put first? So it is possible.
But you need 10 of them.
Right. But is it probable? Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, Manchin's argument is that he's working with the seven and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, but again, I'm sitting there going, yeah, but that doesn't get you to 60. Right. So I still don't understand.
And also, I didn't like the idea that he came out and said, oh, but I would be in support of John Lewis's bill, right? Which we all know is a very narrow bill. And it would only really, really affect the historically racist states. You know, that's the one it really only affects, that bringing back that portion of the Civil Rights Act. And I just think that he knows what's going on. It's happening in all of the red states, unfortunately. And so we really have to deal with that. And I felt like I wish he would have been more specific. You know, it was just him, like you said, trying to get reelected because he wasn't specific at all about what about the bill he did not like. We were listening, but we didn't get any substance from him. And that was, you know, unfortunate.
The John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which would restore federal oversight over state-level voting laws, changes to protect minority groups that might be targeted. Manchin cited one Republican Senator, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, as a supporter of the measure, which would give the Justice Department powers to police voting rights that the Supreme Court took away in 2013. That decision freed nine states, mainly in the South, to change voting laws without pre-approval from Washington. After the 2020 election, many of those states and several others jumped at the chance, powered by the false claim that voting in November was rife with fraud.
And we know already that Georgia, I believe in Florida, have already met the minimum requirements, right? So they're, you know, it's going to be hard for the Justice Department to go in now and, you know, clean this up. I mean, yes, some of the voter casting portions of their law are obviously, you know, bringing water, you know, that kind of stuff. We're going to clean that up eventually. I don't think that's going to stand. What we care about is the voter turnout and the voter casting
access
issues and the voter, you know, the ability of the state legislator to go through, go back and overturn a, you know, we think about that kind of substance is what we're thinking about. And so that's, to me, it was just disappointing for him to come out and say it, like, and say that. I think he could have said something, and to say it's a partisan issue, I mean, that really hit hard because it's not a partisan issue, it's a voting issue. It's a democracy
issue. You were disappointed in this guy? You know, he is so clearly
this is the last of the Dixiecrats.
What he is, I mean, how he wants, he comes first. That's all there is to it.
I mean, what's going to happen is what's happening already, is that it's going to end up in the courts. And
we
know there's three lawsuits in Georgia already. It's going to end up in the courts, and judges are going to have to make the decision on whether or not these laws are constitutional. And that's not the way you want this to go. You want it to, you know, the legislators, they should regulate this. But
do you really think that the Supreme Court of the United States, 6-3, is going to do any kind of supportive?
You know, they've surprised me. So they've surprised me.
We had a good ruling in computing, which I won't try to explain, but they had the three most right and the three most left got together on something.
But,
it was,
you know,
stunning.
Had a good immigration ruling a few weeks ago. So I'm not.
But on the political stuff, you know, I mean, I think it's, look, you were absolutely right when it was a matter of, can we steal this election? When the Trumpers were saying, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't steal it. But everything in between, they're going to say yes to.
Yeah, I think they're going to go heavy on state rights.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
Democrats greeted Mr. Manchin's words incredulously. The senator has made similar points before, but doing so in writing in West Virginia carried new weight. His colleagues acknowledge the tenor of the conversation would change this week as the bill moves to a formal drafting process. Senator Blumenthal said, his fidelity and allegiance to the people of West Virginia is beyond question, but I hope that he will recognize equally the responsibility that each of us has to the nation, and we face an unprecedented threat to voting rights and democracy.
They cannot afford to tick him off.
Right.
They need that 50th vote. They just can't afford it.
So if Manchin had been in favor, it had moved forward, you'd have had a vote. The Republicans would have killed it. So all I can see him doing at the moment is protecting Republicans. And so, you know, you got to believe there's something going on.
No, not just protecting Republicans, protecting himself.
Right. He's protecting
himself.
Yeah, but I'm saying, but even if he...
And Libby had it right. You know, that's all it was.
House liberals were even more scathing than those in the Senate who said Manchin's op-ed might as well be titled, Why I'll Vote to Preserve Jim Crow.
Right. That was
the Mondaire Jones.
Right, the
Democratic,
new guy from Westchester.
A regular on Congressional Corner.
A number of times. He's very impressive.
Yeah.
The White House, for its part, declined to comment. Wait for the air to
clear there. But I think, Joe, I think that there was a report that Biden had taken a shot at Mansion.
I had read that too, actually. Yeah. I don't know if it was that. Yeah, I did. I did.
It was
that.
Obscure, but it was a shot.
Yeah, he did. Yes. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue, and we will be back with new topics, but the same great panel. A new formulation, but no. New topics, new hour, but same panels. Panelists. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sanna Friedman-Tolbert, Jim Hendler, and Libby Post all here live and in person. And we welcome you to be not live or in person, but you can write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So I just want to get a couple of letters in here, wrapping up our conversation about Joe Manchin, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Joe says, Sinema, and especially Manchin, are simply closet Republicans. Kevin says, Joe Manchin better hope Democrats don't give up on him in the next election, and he gets removed. Brian says, why don't we change the filibuster number from 60 to 55? Seems like that would make it possible to have a few more pieces of bipartisan legislation actually have a chance. Warr says Chris Wallace, of all people, pointed out to Manchin this weekend that by ruling out the filibuster and voting law, he is giving the GOP no reason to work with Democrats because now they have nothing to fear. Alan, get real, says Kathleen. If the Republicans take back the Senate, they will get rid of the filibuster themselves and then do anything they want. The Dems need to do it now to get whatever progress we are able to get and save democracy if we can.
That's one way of looking at it.
But what should happen and what will happen are two different things, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, look, write me the note after the Republicans win both houses of Congress, or the Senate anyway, where there's a where, it's a long story, but I can tell you that I knew a congressman who used to go up and plant a woman in the audience who would raise her hand to his opponent and say, what do you think, representative or future representative, what do you think about the filibuster in your house? And he'd say, I'm against it. And my friend Thompson would stand up and he would say, there is no filibuster.
In the house, right.
And it worked every time. Amazing.
Chris writes to us, and I love Chris's letter for one reason. He uses a word that I feel is grossly underused. The Democratic Party didn't bestir itself. Isn't bestir such a great word? I love that word. Bestir itself to counter fundamentalist organizing, Ronald Reagan, Newt Gingrich, the 2000 election, or Donald Trump. In consequence, Mitch McConnell will be the grim reaper of American democracy and of the last hope of avoiding irreversible climate change. Final letter before we move on to other stuff. This about Yankees and COVID. It seems people panic when the Yankee player is tested positive. The vaccine doesn't keep you from getting infected. The virus can still get a beachhead in your body, but your body will recognize it, attack it faster and more vigorously, yes, and eventually eliminate it from your body. You should have zero to limited symptoms, recover faster. Everyone who has been vaccinated, if they were tested as often as sports players, could be showing positive all the time with absolutely no symptoms.
And in fact, you know, the flu vaccine, you know, people have been making that analogy here. So let me point out, the flu vaccine does not make it so you don't get the flu. Right. It makes it so that the flu hits you very quickly and goes away compared to what it would do if you didn't have the vaccine.
Right, which could be death.
Yeah.
Let's move on to other topics. Not that I have any problems of just focusing on death, but what the hell? Let's move on. The Vice President of the United States is making a trip to Central America. Migration is on the mind here, and trying to stem migration. And going to the root of the problem, many feel. This is a trip that is being very closely watched. Of course, the president has tasked the vice president to address this issue along with voting rights. We should note, as Vice President Biden led an enormous push to deter people from crossing the United States by devoting hundreds of millions of dollars to Central America, hoping to make the region more tolerable for the poor so that fewer would abandon it. Now, as President Biden is doubling down on that strategy once again and assigning Kamala Harris, the prickly challenge of carrying out his plan to commit $4 billion in a remarkably similar approach as she travels to the region on Sunday. Sienna.
Yeah, I think this is really good. I think Kamala's the Vice President Harris is the excellent person to do this. We recall that she has a history as an attorney general, as a prosecutor, and she's the perfect person to go down there and deal with, I won't call them corrupt governments, but governments that are dealing with corruption issues.
Yes.
And I think that's the main problem.
Like our own, right?
Corruption challenge is what I was looking for there.
Because what I'm hearing as an immigration attorney from a lot of my foreign nationals from Central America is that they're dealing with law enforcement that they can't trust, government that won't support them. They don't feel safe in their own neighborhoods. Their children aren't safe in their own neighborhoods. And it's huge gang cartels. And we have to deal with that issue. And who better than a former prosecutor, an attorney general, to go down and deal with criminal issues than Vice President Harris?
So as I was reading on this topic, I just kept on wondering, okay, and I'll ask you this unfair question, Sienna. So what does $4 billion buy you?
Nice car.
Yeah. In this circumstance, I guess, I should say.
In this circumstance, in Central America, what they're dealing with is a lot of poverty, right? So I feel like if you can get some of that money into the hands of the people that need them, food, infrastructure, schools, I mean, that's what $4 billion will buy you, and that's what will really get you some change in the Central America, so we can start to see them staying in their home countries and not coming to the U.S. Because I always emphasize this, is that individuals coming from Central America, you know, they don't speak English. It's not their culture. It's very hard for them to be here. It's not an easy situation. So it must be a very hard situation for them at home to leave everybody they know. And so I think we have to address that. $4 billion in Central America is a lot of money. And if they get it to the hands of the people, then I think they could make an impact on the ground.
A big if.
Well, it's about getting it into the hands of the people who need it, and that's the problem. I mean, you know, when you know the money goes to these corporations that are supposed to do these programs, and it goes for overhead and all the rest of it. So we see these big Fortune 500 companies that are doing this work, making a lot of money, but then you have people on the ground not getting the benefit of it. So you know, it's. Foreign aid has always been a sticky wicket. It's been it's the carrot and the stick kind of thing. And we spent a lot of time in the 50s bolstering the banana republics of Latin America and South America. And now it's all coming home to roost because there was not a respect for democracy in those governments. And what we have now is criminal enterprises running government. It's totally corrupt.
But we also have the political question, which has been raised, including letters to this program, about whether it's appropriate to, quote, pick on Kamala, who apparently did ask for this assignment herself, and say it's not right. Well, this is a woman who may well end up as president of the United States. I think the odds on right now are that she will. So she's taking on tough assignments. She asks for tough assignments. If she completes them, it just helps her a great deal. You guys look dubious. Is there something I've said that's wrong?
No. So, I mean, you know, I would just point out that Obama sent his vice president, a gentleman named Biden, to deal with this same issue. So, you know, I mean, that
there's always
no one accused that one. So,
Well, I think the picking on. The vice president is absurd because what that is just trying to bring down a woman of color who can potentially be the president of the United States. And there are people in this country who don't want that to happen. So they'll do whatever they can to undermine her credibility.
Well, you know, Libby, I wish I could agree with you. And on some level, I do, of course, that there are many people who want to bring her down. But I think the letter we got on the program was really from somebody who was from the left side of the ledger. And it bothered me a great deal.
What did the letter say?
It said, why are they picking on Kamala by giving her these tough assignments?
Because this is what she signed up for. This is what the job is.
And what the future job is president is going to be.
This is what, look, this was the Obama-Biden partnership. where Biden actually did work, unlike Trump Pence, where he really didn't do much work. And Biden is using that same model for Kamala Harris. And why not? Why shouldn't she be given work to do? Why shouldn't she have major responsibilities? She is a competent woman who will take no gruff and BS from anybody. If there's, she was the Attorney General of California. I mean, come on. She knows how to negotiate. She didn't get to where she is because she's not competent. Let's be honest about that. And she's the one, I think she can make something happen here. I think, you know, her combination of smarts, personality, persuasion, we might make some headway.
And I think that's exactly what we need. The kind of representation that we need going down to Central America is someone that knows how to, you know, change a system. You know, as a DA, she was very controversial because of the systems she put in place down in California. And a lot of people didn't like her, but she did it. And she had a formula, and it worked. And so I just think that she can do that the same thing, especially when you're fighting anti-corruption in Central America. Central America. I think she's the perfect person for the job.
What, as far as meeting with officials in Guatemala, meeting with other officials throughout Central America because of the corrupt nature, I mean, when do we start judging the effectiveness of what happens?
I'm glad you didn't ask me that question.
Well, I just want to note that both Sienna and Libby were, like, their eyes were rolling.
Well, no, I mean, you know, if people expect there to be a change the week after she's there, they're naive and don't understand how the process works. It's going to take a while, but if there can be some real conversation and agreements on how the money is going to be spent and get the money into the hands of the people who need it, not into the pockets of those who will benefit, you know, profit from it, then, you know, that's when we'll see it. But it's not going to be overnight. People need to be realistic.
And that is, as I said before, a big if. That will get into the right hands.
And you also have to remember that, you know, Vice President Harris, she is a child of an immigrant. She's very close to the situation, and she understands the impact. And I think that she's going to ask for some accountability from the government, and I think she's going to ask for some transparency from the Central American government. And I think if they don't give it, they're going to get it's going to be a hard line for her.
And as well, she should be asking for all of that.
Exactly.
All right, let's go to other topics here and get to other stuff. All right, I just went. There was some Supreme Court stuff that I thought was breaking, but I don't think it's anything we need to necessarily talk about at this very second because I don't have a whole lot of information on it. But we're getting to that season where the decisions are going to be coming in every day. It'll be fun.
Good time.
We'll get to talk about it. About 10:10 every morning, we'll get to talk about new stuff that we weren't expecting because the Supreme Court will be weighing in on major issues. And of course, we'll be talking about that. Okay, Jim Henler, time for you. Let's talk about the other big story of this weekend. It started us off this weekend, and that was that Facebook, we had you on when they said they were going to look at this, but they were going to suspend him for an unspecified period of time. Now the folks at Facebook have suspended the president for 2 years and saying he cannot return until, quote, risk to public safety is receded. My question is, what device do you have to have on your dashboard that registers that?
Jim.
Yeah, it's you know, I'll buy you one, Joe. We got it in the back of my office.
Oh, obviously. Public safety is receding, and I need gas.
Obviously, these are complicated issues, yeah. And you know that's part of what their ethics board was forcing them to do is make some of these decisions. I think you know it's pretty obvious when the ex-president is wandering around saying, you know, I'm calling for a coup and I'm going to be back in my office on August 6th that the danger has not the risk has not receded. And I think basically what they're really saying is that we're going to set these times and then we're going to revisit. And what we're going to look for is changes in behavior. And if people don't change their behavior, they won't be allowed back on.
Well,
and
then we don't have to worry.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. So, I mean, I'd be very surprised if he ends up back on Facebook. On the other hand, I can also see that when the next election runs around, if Trump is actually being nominated, Facebook will be looking at the dollars. So 2 years was a very interesting time to pick right now.
Because it'll bring it right to 2023, a year before, assuming if he were to run, you assume that he would make an announcement in the spring of, of the year before running. So, yes, it is a very interesting time frame.
Facebook is nothing if not.
Maybe, but, you know, I think Facebook recognizes, as many of us do, that Trump is not only a potential despot, but a despot who wants to lead this country into a fascistic modality. And you know, I think it's extraordinary that they've gone as far as they have. I want to give them a little credit for saying no to Trump. Because this whole country isn't worth anything if he gets away with the kind of stuff that he's wanted to.
I agree with that, Ellen. But I mean, look at Twitter and some of the others that have banned him permanently, right? Yeah, well, Facebook is really dancing a fine line. That said, it's money, but it's also a complicated issue. You know, they're getting criticized from both sides, sure. Right? Because in fact, if you actually look at the enforcement and the numbers, and a colleague of mine who works at Facebook shared some of these, more left-wing accounts have been suspended than right-wing accounts.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
In general. I mean, part of that's just the demographic of who got on Facebook when and things like that.
What would be a good example of a left-wing account that has been suspended?
A revolutionary account. You know, back when we were kids, Alan, think of SDS and people like that.
Yeah.
Or the people who would have created that.
There's
been a lot of questions about some of the black rights movements and things like that. They haven't really suspended on that. But some of the calls for violence around that have led to things. They've also been doing a lot of small blocking, things like that. So, you know, they block a lot of individual things rather than saying we're taking your account away. Taking your account away requires a consistent and very
long. So when you say individual things, something that they said and they...
Right.
So this particular Facebook post will be blocked. And they're using a lot of automated tools for that. So
they also put people in Facebook jail. They suspend them. I have a friend locally who calls people out on their racism, and he's the one who gets suspended.
Now, go ahead.
Didn't something just happen with Twitter in Nigeria where Nigeria banned Twitter because they blocked him? They blocked they did something to the president. It just came up when we were talking about it.
Yeah, so.
How Nigeria's Twitter ban stands to impact people in business, Jim?
Yep. So. You know, there's a whole tit-for-tat thing going on, okay? So imagine you ban Trump. Excuse me. Imagine you ban Trump when he was the president, right? Then he could have turned around and, you know, done something to Facebook, right? And would have cried. So what's happening in Nigeria is roughly that. They were suspending accounts that were related to the government, is my understanding. And the government said, well, then we'll just turn off Twitter here. It's now illegal to tweet in Nigeria.
But didn't they suspend him when he was still President Trump? And he did try to do things, didn't he?
The suspension came post-election, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Yeah, it was after.
Right. I thought it was.
But post-election,
but he was still president.
He was still president.
You know, saying that he won and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And it was really January 6th that's what really did it.
All right. Anyone else on that? The other thing I'm wondering about is, so how does that impact other, how can you say this? Other conservative voices, other Trump allies, like his kids?
It's unclear, right? At the moment, most of those accounts haven't been suspended because they haven't been as impactful. They haven't been demonstrated to have some kind of impact. That's kind of the claim they're making, is that you have to be able to show that somebody's listening and that things are happening. And again, it's that fine line thing. How do you determine? They have boards that do it. They have technology involved. They're not really telling anybody the details. So if it sounds like I'm hedging a little, that's because I'm hedging a little.
But I recall that Twitter was shutting down accounts that were posting his press releases, I think.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they were like posting his press releases, and Twitter shut that down as well. So it's interesting to see how everyone else is treating like his attempts to go around the rules.
His so-called social media site that was going to revolutionize the world and have billions of followers and got shut down after
days because it was totally useless and no one was reading it comparatively.
But, what does that say about...
But what he was hoping is those things would go out and the bands did work.
I was hoping, when we talked about that story, I was sorry you weren't here, but with the quote-unquote blog, what does that tell us about blogs in general and just the fact of how... I mean, what we were talking about at the time was people... If you wanted to see it, you would go through it, but it would be you had to go through several steps and make it much more difficult than it is to put it, follow it in your Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter feed.
Well, it's that, but it's also the social media effect, right? Is friend of a friend, as it's called, right? So it's not that I'm following Trump necessarily; it's that the people I know who are following Trump are sending things to me. So I'm seeing something from three or four different angles at the same time. I'm seeing Libby has sent me something and Sienna has sent me something. And so now I'm tempted to believe it because I've now seen it from two people I trust, even though it may have come from the same source, things like that. With the blog, you don't get that. So you do get people pointing at it. And since pointing at it and when you would click on it, it wouldn't be there unless you did some things, as Libby said. It was complicated. And so I think some of that's that. But I think mostly it's that you don't get this what's called the network effect. Right. The network effect is sort of simple to explain. Right. If you're the only person in the world with a telephone, it's useless. Right. If there's one other person in the world with a telephone, there's only one person you can call. Right. Once there are 10 people, each of you can call each other. Suddenly there's 100 calls that can be made and on and on and on. So this is exponential growth. So in particular for these kind of networks. And so the social media has a very strong network effect, and he couldn't get a network effect off of the blog, and that's really where a lot of it came from.
Just leading to a fast question, Jim, with your incredible knowledge, blogs. A lot of people writing blogs.
I'm sorry?
Thousands of people writing blogs. Are they effective? Are they working? What's going on?
They can be. Now the big thing is video blogs and podcasts.
So
and those are placing it mostly because people just don't want to read. But, you know, I read my blog out loud and I get 2,000 followers. I put my blog in print. I get 200 followers. It becomes clear that a podcast wins. But no, there are still a lot of blogs.
But accessing social media the way we do the scrolling.
Mm-hmm.
People are not reading as much, sitting down to read as much a book as they used to, except maybe Joe. But, you know, it does impact how we read and what our brains are.
Well, and also, you know, there's been a change. This is actually a good point, Libby. So, for example, as social media has moved to a phone-based platform primarily, we've actually seen some differences in how long people look at things. So when you're looking at it on a big screen, you're seeing a lot of stuff at the same time. You can skim it quickly. When you're looking at the phone, you have to make a conscious decision to keep reading. And so a lot of people read sort of the first paragraph and stop.
Dip in, dip out, right? See if it interests you and then move on to other stuff.
Right. And then the other rule of the web is three clicks and you're out. So if you can't get to it in three clicks, don't bother. And that's been another problem with some of these blogs. If I can share it on Facebook, you click, you get to my blog. If I can't share it on Facebook, you got to do multiple steps.
Well, and this is a problem. Even you know, we're getting into a bigger issue. We have to go to a break. But this is the problem when people share newspaper stories on Twitter or Facebook, and then you're like, oh, I'm interested in that, and you click on it, and then you're not a subscriber, and you have to get, you know, give us your email address, and then suddenly you're in this whole thing, and then you just bail on it and say, I don't really care. All right, let's take a break. We will be back in just a moment for our final go-around with our panel. Alan, Sienna, Jim, and Libby will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our last go-around with our terrific panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Sienna Friedman-Tolbert, Jim Henler, and Libby Post. So let's go to some letters here before we go to our final topic of the morning. Quite a few, so we're sort of all over the place here as far as topics of everything that we've discussed, but that's okay. Patrick says, on influencing Joe Manchin, there are bound to be infrastructure issues and economic stimulus issues that West Virginians would like to have. Highways, bridges, high-speed wireless internet, new industries, federal government jobs, carbon fiber research to make cars and trucks from coal, wind turbines, etc. Breathe. The Dems should focus on finding the issues that would influence Manchin to vote with the Senate Democrats, speak to him directly, or through his voters.
As my dad used to say, don't confuse me with the facts.
Right. That's exactly it.
Let's see. We go to this one from Nancy. If the administration was serious about alleviating crime and corruption south of our border, we would decriminalize or even better, legalize all drug use here in the United States and treat addiction as a medical, not criminal matter. Joe Biden, who has helped push through the disastrous crime bill and has a son afflicted by drug problems, should understand this, but he's stuck in his mindset on this.
He also wants to win re-election.
Anybody else on that? Hearing none, we move on to Tom, who says, isn't it incredibly remarkable that both – try it again. Isn't it incredibly remarkable that a sitting president was banned from social media? The sheer power these companies have is something both sides of the aisle should be concerned about. I'm interested in the thoughts of the panel, but from Alan in particular. A little pressure there.
Yeah,
from
but
Tom.
I don't fully understand the question, if somebody could help interpret it.
I think it's the power of the social media companies versus
the media. We know that they're pretty powerful. And, you know, we know that the chances of them being reined in are not that good.
Well, so actually the really interesting thing right now politically is both the left and the right agree they need to, that something needs to change. The problem is they have different opinions how to do it and are not talking to each other. It all relates to one sentence in one law, which gives these social media companies a lot of indemnity from a lot of things. And pretty much everyone agrees that has to be changed. The question is how and what rules. You know, my personal preference would be to treat them like media. Mm-hmm. And there have been attempts
make sense.
To do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, you've argued with me about that in the past. But so, for example, when I see a political ad on TV, it has to say, my name is so-and-so, and I endorse this ad, or tell me who did it. And when I see a political ad on Facebook, it doesn't tell me who paid for it.
Yes, mm-hmm. It does.
Now, but it doesn't tell me it was paid for by the Russian such and such.
Well, but like it
doesn't have to.
Oh, yes, it does. It doesn't say if it was paid by the Russians, but it does have to say who placed the ad.
Well, that's changed now. You're right.
Give your firstborn male grandchild
to be allowed. Yeah, but you have no, but it's not exposed to the person who sees the ad. It's
yes, it is.
Oh, sometimes it is. Sometimes
oh, no.
Or they changed that? Okay.
Oh, it is. It is.
That's
it says,
new. Okay.
Because I run political ads all the time for local elections, and it says paid for by whomever, friends of whoever.
They're going to do that right after they do baseball.
Right. Baseball what?
Well, you know that baseball is not in the... Isn't that true? Baseball is not considered to be something or other.
America's pastime?
No.
A political issue. It's not a political issue?
No. Baseball is immunized.
Oh, right.
You mean from antitrust.
Yes. Antitrust.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So well, the football, all the sports leagues are, for the most part. NFL, the
That ain't
baseball.
Right.
I know it's not right, but the NCAA...
Social media is not indemnified exactly, but they fall. The real problem is the law hasn't caught up with them.
Sure.
And the scale is such that, you know, you can't look at these things on the narrow way we tend to look at these things in law. It's very tricky.
Part of it is that they're not licensed. You guys are licensed. Television stations are licensed by the FCC. Mm. Social media is not licensed.
Not licensed.
And it never was. And to get them to be licensed now, I think, you know, the cow's out of the barn. So.
Those congressional hearings when they brought Facebook down to answer questions. I don't know if Congress is equipped to discuss it. They don't have, you know, I think they need to do a lot of research and they need to get a lot of interns in there to explain it to them before
maybe
they can even address it.
Maybe look at Facebook for 10 minutes before.
Right. I'm just saying.
Like, we're aware of its existence would help.
Right.
Yes.
You know, any legislator who will say the Facebook, you know. It's like,
I don't know if they're equipped to
the internet.
Facebook's the internet.
The interwebs.
Well, and to be fair, we're all using the term, just to be clear, we're all using the term Facebook to represent a lot of big companies, a lot of powerful. So part of this problem is, remember, what the stuff you're not seeing behind the websites, and Google has a lot of the same thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so we talk about Facebook and Twitter, but, you know, all these things have a lot of connectivity, and it's a very, very deep thing. A lot of private information is exchanged and changed on these things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really consumer privacy protection that has the most likelihood of getting
I'm sorry, there. I did take some exception, Libby, to your saying that the Facebook was the issue. Where I live in Western Massachusetts, everything takes a the. So, you know, the Price Chopper, the...
That's lovely, except that's not the name of the organization.
Well, although Libby, you'll be amused to know that it originally was, it was one of their first media-savvy people who said, drop the...
I know, it's true. And it was, his name... The guy who played it in the movie is the guy who's the singer, who was Justin Timberlake. Was the person who's played that in the movie, in the social network, and said,
"Was the Napster
drop it.
Guy, right?
Yeah.
All right.
I can't think of it. Remember who played him on TV.
And I can never forget the name Winklevoss.
Yeah, so. I know. There is the twins,
the Winklevoss twins,
and they ended up with a lot of money.
Winklevi,
as we call them.
Yes, the Winklevi. All right. Last time you were on, Jim, we were talking about ransomware. We were talking about how it affected the pipeline. We were also talking about how it even possibly affected RPI. We didn't know at the time. I don't know. Do we still know? We don't know.
He has a deer look in the head.
No. So, wait. There's three different questions
The overall issue that we discussed that I think is interesting that we're talking about in the news is that since the pipeline, we have the meat plant and we have schools and people are having trouble getting chemotherapy, and this ransomware has kind of taken over these very, I don't want to say mundane, but very important aspects of our everyday life.
Okay. So, Alan, the deer in the headline, the reason I can't talk much about RPI is because we have an FBI investigation going on, and you know, you're really not supposed to talk about what's happening. But
And also, you guys did okay in this thing, didn't you? You didn't have to pay. We don't know that.
To my knowledge, no payment was made to anyone. The ransomware thing is very complicated, as no doubt you've guessed. And, you know, as Libby pointed out about the CDC when we were talking about them before, they're coming out of 4 years of complete dysfunction. DHS got assigned before Trump got elected to become the place that was going to centralize all of the control of government activity in the cyberspace. Trump felt the only issue that DHS cared about was proving that the Russians were mucking with his election. So he basically kept that fairly dysfunctional. And they did a lot. CISA is the organization, did a fair amount of election security, but couldn't really get into some of these hard issues. And so what you've been seeing happening on ransomware is that the criminals are very smart, and it's been, you know, so first of all, there's no law in our country that you have to tell what happened, right? And if you look at Colonial, they probably lost more money from the panics at the gas tanks than they lost from the ransomware attack. Ransomware guys typically try to end up at around 1% of your total.
They have a formula?
There's a formula, partly because securing your stuff costs more than that. And insuring your stuff costs more than that. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, the pipeline would have cost more if they hadn't paid than if they did. And, of course, their insurance is probably causing them to pay off. If you look at kidnapping and things like that, you get similar things. There's actually a whole profession now of ransomware negotiator. I just learned about this recently. I was trying to think if I had a new career, but I don't think I have the personal skills you need. but it's really get the number down.
Well, now I'm fascinated. And what are the personal skills that you need that you would
apparently
not have?
Well, apparently it's like being a hostage negotiator.
Oh, you so have patience?
Have empathy, patience, friendliness, right, social skills.
So none of us can get
pretty
that
much
job.
Everything that a computer scientist doesn't typically have. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, some of the people that might have a shot. But seriously, So, you know, there's a lot of different analogies that are being made these days. The Somali pirates to the U.S. after, you know, going after terrorism after 9/11, when it suddenly became clear that there was a problem, even though a lot of people knew about it before. I think there's kind of a Wild West thing going on here. And it's I often, you know, say it's sort of comparable to bank robberies in the days of the Bonnie and Clyde and the you know, actually we made heroes out of the bank robbers, but in theory they were the bad guys. And eventually what we came up with was you had to have a combination of cooperation between the banks, the sort of private companies, the Pinkertons and the detectives and things, the bank guards, and the government. So once you had government insurance for those banks that had done the right things, you had a real change. So bank robbery never went away, but it became much less of a problem, and it became much less of every bank for itself, every person for itself, every government for itself. We must do something like that for ransomware. Of course, we're going to have to do that in a government that is not at the moment very good at making these kind of best for everyone decisions, and we're going to need the banks to play along. Well, we're going to need the companies to play along with the government, and we're going to need to do it. But as this problem grows, we're seeing it at, you know, now that it's becoming public and now that we're seeing the scope of the problem, which many of people have known and we've been talking about, I don't think it's the tragedy that some people say. Again, like bank robbery, like kidnapping, you know, it gets under control. It never goes away completely, but it gets harder and harder and it gets less and less impactful. And that's where we're probably going to have to go with this, or we're going to have to stop using computers. Those are your two choices, and that's not really going to work.
What interested me in the article, and we only have about 2 minutes left, but what interested me in the writing of this, about this topic, is that, you know, we were looking at the pipeline, which has obviously huge effect, I mean, on the entire, you know, country and the world, really. But there is money to be made if you just have ransomware on the ferry system going to Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
You can make money off that.
You take 1% of that.
Yeah, but, you know, again, it's 1% of what these companies are worth. Hospitals have had the biggest problem. They have very bad traditional data security. Yeah. They had, it's hard to explain, the way HIPAA works, we were talking about before, put some rules about data security, which are very, very strict, but it also makes many, many of the systems look similar. So once you can break into one of them, you can break into lots of them. So a lot of the hospitals, we had local governments, we had local police forces. One of the local high schools.
I feel like you're giving out too many tips here. I think, as an attorney, I feel like you should.
It's one of the classes they teach us. Yeah. Sign them up.
Yeah. We have students who scare me. No.
Yeah, I asked you that.
We have white hat. No. So, but by the way, that's the other thing you need. You need educated people who are taught how to fight these things, and that requires people who understand it. And, you know, we can't have this mentality that says we can't teach our students this stuff. But that said, we have to be careful, and there have to be limits. But really, transparency is the biggest thing we don't have, and we need more of.
All right. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody who was with us this morning here in the studio. Alan Chartok. Thank you very much, Alan.
Fun being here.
Always good to see you. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, wonderful to meet you. And, well, I mean, we've met over the phone. But it's
see you.
Like an old friend, but it's nice to finally have you here in the studio.
Better.
Jim and Libby, thank you very much. We'll be back after this.
Great to see you.